In the 15th century, guns were often seen as the devil's weapon. Unchivalrous and unmanly, they were viewed with suspicion by the European elite. Within 100 years, this had changed. Guns were now luxury items among the rich, sometimes in odd novelty combination with axes, pole arms, or with multiple barrels. Today, we'll be exploring why and when this changed. Hello, my name is Gareth Edwards, and welcome to the Untitled History Podcast. Join me each week alongside world-leading experts as we take a deep dive into your favorite topics from throughout history. From the ancient world to the modern, and with plenty of historical rabbit holes in between, we'll cover famous and not so famous moments in history from all across the globe. The Italian peninsula has long been referred to as the birthplace of the Renaissance. That environment didn't just create a breeding ground for art and culture. It created the opportunity for firearms to become culturally normalized. The Beretta Company, for example, dates back to 1526, the year before Machiavelli's death. It is in Italy that Europe began to see what might be called the domestication of firearms start in earnest. Often the study of the history of firearms focuses on their use in warfare. But as one of my favorite historians once wrote, there does not have to have been a military revolution for there to have been a firearm revolution. So with me to discuss all of that on this episode today is, in fact, that favourite historian, Catherine Fletcher. Say hello, Catherine.
Oh, you're very kind. Hello, everybody.
So for those unfamiliar with Catherine's work, Catherine Fletcher is Professor of History at Manchester Metropolitan University and works mainly on 16th century history, especially of Italy. A Guardian reviewer once said that she specialised in Renaissance skullduggery, which you can find in several of her books, I can vouch for that, including The Black Prince of Florence and The Beauty and the Terror, an alternative history of the Italian Renaissance. You're also burying the lead slightly in that description you've given me, Catherine, because there's a very specific reason I wanted you on this episode, isn't there?
Yes, so I'm here to talk about the newest book of Renaissance skullduggery, which is The Firearm Revolution from Princeton University Press, which has just come out this month.
And this was absolutely, once you released that book, I was like, oh, brilliant, finally someone, because this has been a topic that's fascinated me for years. I'm a big fan of wandering around museums and looking giant cabinets of guns and swords and everything. But at the same time, with my historian hat on, I get frustrated because that's not really the natural environment many of these decorative guns and things would have been shown in. And that's something that comes through to me in your work, is it really looks at firearms not just as a weapon of war, but how they fit into that general cultural Renaissance.
Yeah, you get this weird situation in museums where guns are put into one room and other things put into a different room. So the tapestries will be over here and the guns will be over there, possibly in a completely different wing of the museum. But historically, those things were in the same room. They belong together. Guns are a part of the elite culture. In fact, they're a part of culture across society, from everybody from the guy trying to herd his cows who has now bought himself a new handgun to, you know, the elite princes and kings who are also going out hunting or trialing a new military technology or having a luxury gun given to them as a gift. So yeah, they're all over the place. And I think that was one of the things I wanted to try and dig into in the book, is just how pervasive this new technology becomes. I mean, in my case study is primarily Italian society, but across Europe and beyond, guns end up all over the place.
But let's start by maybe setting the scene for listeners. I mentioned obviously in the introduction that there's this big shift in the perception of weapons, and that's going to be something we cover as we go through the episode in terms of firearms. But maybe would you be okay setting the scene for people in how were firearms sort of regarded as we enter the 1500s, as we enter the 16th century, at the beginning of that period?
So firearms in general are the devil's work. I mean, this is a popular perception. They are diabolical. They are not a good thing. And this idea, actually, I mean, it's still going in the 20th century. You get people writing books about arms trading called The Devil's Traffic into the 20th century. So, you know, that doesn't disappear entirely. But, yeah, no, my favorite image, one of my favorite images, at least, in the book is 15th century French illuminated manuscript, a religious manuscript, a Book of Hours. And it's got this image of the resurrection of Christ. And Christ has got out of his tomb and is walking down the street. And there are two little demons up on a balcony shooting a handgun down at him. And I think that really sums up in visual form the idea that guns are the devil's weapon. And this is, it's a motif that keeps coming back. You know, there's multiple types of source will refer to guns as diabolical. So they're diabolical, they're also rather unchivalrous. And that idea persists. So the fact that an ordinary peasant with a handgun can shoot a knight off his horse, that's somehow, that's not really proper, is it? You know, men should get up, get together and fight each other rather than shooting like a coward from a distance. And this isn't completely new with guns. It's been said previously with crossbows. Actually, if you go back further in time, all sorts of missile weapons have this reputation as being slightly problematic. But when we get to guns, because guns are so much more lethal, because of the power, the velocity of the shot, the impact that something going into your body at that speed has in terms of wounding, this is all magnified. So we really see an idea that guns are bad in two senses. They are this sort of idea of the devil's work, perhaps even taking the power of life and death away from God and towards human beings. And then also, you know, they don't fit the culture of chivalry.
Like you say, this is in some ways an evolution of something we've seen. I've done a lot of study in the past on the longbow as a weapon of war, and particularly in the period and the Hundred Years' War and similar. And you get stuff in that period where it's like that. There's almost similar things said about the longbow. It gets exaggerated in media, as often these things do. But there is a perception that, well, actually, you've got a bunch of Welshmen running around with bows here and they can kill French knights. And that is genuinely in certain circles regarded as how dare they? And it's, for me, it's fascinating that firearms almost inherit that. As you say, it comes via crossbows first almost, but mm-hmm. it carries on and inherits through that. I mean, you've got that, it's a Leonard Fronsberger. I love the his sort of war book, the ex-captain of the Ducal Armory in Munich in 1573. And he's where that unmanliness comes from that I used in the intro, and I know you use in the book as well, is that he's the one who describes them as horrible and unmanly. And he's a former soldier. He's a professional soldier. He sees them in that lens, doesn't he? These are a thing that can equip less trained people to seriously damage very well-trained or elite people.
Yeah, although I think that the complete lack of training idea is a little bit of a myth, because actually the way that guns work in practice on the battlefield is you need quite a lot of group cohesion and discipline to make the pike and shot method work, because you can't have untrained individuals going off, letting their gun off whenever. They've got to be firing in lines to the drumbeat. They've got to be disciplined. They've got to be ordered. And that actually does take a level of training. And I think it's not it's not a completely random individual thing, but at the same time, it does really cut against that idea that the knight is sort of superior, when now you have the almost like this human machine gun, these lines of men trained to fire one at a time. You know, the way this works, you line up your shooters in a square, the first line fires, and then they kneel down and reload. The line behind fires over their heads, and then they do the same till they get to the back of the formation, by which time the front line is ready to stand up again and shoot. And so it does take quite a lot of training to get people to the point where they can effectively do that in the chaos of the battlefield. But yeah, all that said, that doesn't stop this sort of myth, if you like, that they are a nasty, cowardly weapon, that they are the weapon of the wretch. And yeah, even soldiers will write this. And people who've been commanders, people who've seen the damage that guns can do, will often come out of that and be quite, you know, ambivalent or even hostile about them. And this sort of double thinker about guns is a bit of a theme throughout the book, in a way that on the one hand, militaries want to have guns. They're the up-to-date weapon. Governments say, right, okay, we're going to need to use this weapon. Everybody else has got it. We have to have it too. But at the same time, they don't really like it. It struggles to really get adopted into the culture for quite some time after it's first successful on the battlefield.
So we should stop here briefly, I think, because this is a good time to do it. And at a very high level, talk about what we mean when we're talking about guns here. Like, I suspect between us, we could geek out for hours about the varieties of Renaissance guns. But at a very high level, we're looking at the period in history where we're starting to see a move from matchlock weapons to wheel lock weapons, aren't we? And how would you describe the difference between the two?
Okay, so very, very basic for beginners. A gun's got three bits: a lock, a stock, and a barrel. The barrel is where the shot gets fired out of, the metal tube. The stock is the wooden casing, and the lock is the firing mechanism. So in your older matchlock, the lock works by having a long piece of match cord, essentially a sort of a piece of rope, thin rope, if you like, which slowly burns. And when you pull the trigger of your gun, this gets sort of tipped onto the powder, powder lights, shot fires. A wheel lock works more like your old-fashioned type of cigarette lighter, which has got a little metal wheel, and when you pull your thumb down on the wheel, it creates a spark that lights the lighter fuel. Well, that's more or less the principle of the wheel lock, and the difference is that the wheel lock doesn't need a lighted match. So just like you can put your old cigarette lighter in your pocket and walk around with it, you can wind up your wheel lock gun on a spring mechanism, put it in your pocket, and walk around with it. This is what causes all sorts of anxiety about the potential for banditry and assassinations and crime in general, because, you know, anybody could be walking the streets with one of these guns in their pocket. But that's the transition. It's quite a long transition. It's quite a slow transition because wheel locks are expensive. They're not necessarily as reliable as being able to see a lighted match. But they're good for hunting because you don't have the smell of sulfur from the match cord. You don't have the light. So if you're trying to go hunting, you don't want to attract the attention of prey, then a wheel lock gives you some advantages.
It's an interesting one because long-term listeners of the podcast will know that I've previously done an episode on the growth of highwaymen, of highway robbery in the aftermath of the English Civil War. And it's really like the two things we talked about here, the gradual progression of and availability of guns, particularly in a post-Civil War environment, and the availability of matchlock pistols are two of the things that really, really play into that growth because they enable the ability to move around with a gun in that way, to have nine of them on your person and on your horse that you can just pull out and use. And so I find it quite fascinating the parallels that we see that early and we see that starting to happen here in Italy. And we are primarily focusing this podcast on Italy because it's so important to this. And maybe I'll just give a bit of a rough background on the rough situation in Italy as we start this very important century for Italy almost. So we're in the period coming through the period that is often referred to as the Italian Wars. And the very, very short version of this for those unfamiliar with that period is France and Spain are going at it, and they're going at it over the Italian peninsula and the inheritances of various places in the Italian peninsula. And you've got all the Italian city-states and semi-independent ruling duchies and everything else, all in that mass of everything else as well. And that's creating a general atmosphere where you've got military activities underway, you've got heavy use of mercenaries as forces, which in itself feeds into firearms in ways we can talk about in a bit. But it also means you've got this explosion of arms industries, of local power bases for individuals, and all these things start. I mean, do you feel that's maybe what makes Italy a kind of a perfect melting pot for this move towards firearms as a civilian thing as much as a military thing?
In Italy, is very significant in this story, partly because it happened to be the main theatre of war in Western Europe at this time. So if you go to tell the story of guns, then you probably tell it from the point of view of what's going on in the Italian wars, which go, I mean, start in 1494 and really the final peace treaty doesn't come until 1559. So you've got lots and lots of, you know, military tactics being tried out and developed on the Italian peninsula with a level of intensity and interest that perhaps isn't the same elsewhere. Although I should say that there's a major center for firearm production in southern Germany at this point. And actually the development of the matchlock with its wooden stock is probably a German development, but it really comes into its own as a military technology at the beginning of the 16th century in Italy. And interestingly, it's not the mercenaries who really pull it off in the first instance. It's the Spanish army, the army of the new Spanish nation, which has, of course, been formed through the union of Castile and Aragon and then the conquest of Granada. And so this Spanish national army sort of has this sense of camaraderie. There's a really interesting book by Eden Scherer about how the Spanish army works in this period, but they are able to pull off some of these military tactics using firearms because they are extremely well drilled and they have some extremely impressive generals who pioneer these techniques when they are fighting for Naples around about the turn of the century from the 1400s to the 1500s. So yeah, that's when we come into this story. And of course, these are seasonal wars. So, you know, people are fighting in the summer and then in the winter, they're taking their gun, which is a personal weapon, doesn't belong to the central stores. It's not like the artillery. It's a personal weapon to the soldier. And they're going off home to have a break, at least some of them. So the guns very quickly proliferate out of the military circles.
This is something I find fascinating as well, because you get, certainly on the Italian city-state side, I mean, we'll talk a bit more about it in a bit, I think, in detail, but like you get those kind of growth of those city militias, of those town militias, and for them, things like an arquebus is really, really useful as a weapon. Is one thing I found fascinating, both in terms of the sources you cite, and it comes from the book as well, is that you get almost that early differentiation in gun control sometimes. So as guns become a thing, gun control is there from the beginning. And that what you sometimes see is, if you're a member of a militia or a force that's based around a town or a city, you might have a central armory that you can return that weapon to, and the weapons are more heavily regulated and stored there. But if you're a member of, if you're a rural farmer who is part of a force, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I think you mentioned the book, I think Siena at one point, for example, requires 30-ish% of its people to be part of the militia. And that means that those that aren't in the cities are going to be keeping that gun at home. And that helps transition it to a sort of sense of normality, I think.
Yeah, and by the end of the century, there's almost a requirement that if you're in these countryside militias, you've got your gun on you. You are never too far away from your gun because you might be called upon to defend your city. And so this is the impact of these ongoing on-off wars, is that every city wants to be prepared. And certainly, you know, you look at the records in Ferrara or in Florence when they fear that they're going to be besieged, loads of people have firearms. So these things are getting out there. People are incentivized to acquire shooting skills. So we see a lot of the city-states organizing competitions. So you're going to have a shooting competition. We've got lovely prizes here. You can win a length of luxury cloth, the palio. So you might know the palio is the name of the horse race in Siena. Now that's where we mostly hear about it. But the palio is actually the prize, which is this length of fabric. And these luxury fabrics were super, super, super expensive at the time. So these are very nice prizes. There are also cash prizes available. And you go along and you shoot at the target. And if you are the winner, then, you know, you're going to come away not just, you know, having won something, but also having defended, you know, the liberty of the fatherland, as they put it in the sort of the decree promoting this competition. So there's a lot of that. And one of the things I love about the documents and records is that actually you see these sketches of the targets in the record with a note of where the winning shots ended up. And I think that's a great sort of document to come across, the actual, you know, physical notes of this particular shooting contest. Also, people cheating. That was my other favourite.
Yeah, I love that. You know, I think you mentioned it in the book, the guy who effectively enters the competition twice and finishes second.
Yeah, exactly. He's great. Yeah. But there's a lot of dodgy characters around in the book. I mean, it's, you know, I suppose like any walk of life, it's going to attract those stories, and then those stories get reported and written up because they're quirky, they're fun, you know, somebody's in trouble.
But they also get written up because they're of interest. And that's the thing with this is if it wasn't of interest or relevant or identifiable to other people, they wouldn't write it up. So it's back to that theme again, like normalization. It must be becoming a normal thing if that's how it's regarded. But I also thought it's interesting, as you say, the Italian focus or the focus on the Italian peninsula seems to be very much more around this as a, yes, it's a service to the homeland. When you're learning to shoot, you're learning to shoot so you are better in your militia. You know, you're better in service to the state. Whereas back to, you mentioned, obviously, Germany being almost the place where the wooden stock is born, where those southern Germany, where a lot of the early industry starts. A lot of the early luxury industry, as I understand it, starts there for weapons as well. But also the German states, when they have their own shooting competitions, they're not just about defensive. It's as much about diplomacy as it is defense. It's the inviting people from other towns to participate. And my understanding from your work, from others, is Italy is far more internally focused. It is often you're not even inviting anyone from surrounding areas to participate.
No, exactly. The shooting contests in Italy are very much about let's equip our town to defend itself against the quite real prospect of getting invaded. Whereas I think in the German city-states and the towns which have been hosting these shooting contests and sending people, you know, to and from the shooting contests, I don't get the sense that there's quite that same urgency, which is understandable when you've had the two biggest armies in Europe fighting an ongoing war across the peninsula. Then Italy is going to respond differently to, you know, how it drills, how it develops an arms industry, what individual people are thinking they are doing with guns. And then, of course, you have all the problem, and come back to the highway robbery question, of demobilized soldiers with guns who need to make a living somehow. And, you know, a proportion of them do go in for banditry. And so you then get this circle whereby the roads become more risky, more people want to carry guns when they're traveling for self-defense. And you get that sort of spiral and escalation of gun ownership, where people who might not have chosen to have a gun initially decide that they better have one because the other guy has got one.
You've got people like, we start to see records of Cosimo Medici issuing guns to his bodyguard. You know, that they have bodyguard. There's a great account in there of the Duke of Urbino being given permission to arm his bodyguard with matchlock guns in 1551 by the Venetian authorities.
It's wheel lock guns.
It's fascinating to see that transition.
Yeah, and I think the bodyguards are an interesting case because the bodyguard supplies get out of hand. So the Duke of Urbino, who is effectively captaining the Venetian armed forces, his bodyguard are allowed to wear these wheel locks and even sometimes come into the city of Venice with them, which is pretty unusual because nobody else is allowed to have a wheel lock in the city of Venice. But then you start to get a bit of a spreading out where other people want them. And in Bologna, you know, there's a bunch of city officials who are allowed to have servants with guns. And then they put out a decree which says, look, the servants with guns are there to be your bodyguards. They are not there just to go off on their own with their guns wherever they like. They're entitled to carry guns when they are with you, not just, you know. And I keep, these people are always like pushing and pushing and pushing at the rules and what they're entitled to do and who's entitled to have a license. And you do get a sense that there are a lot of people going around saying, no, I have got a license because my cousin went down the city hall and the city hall told my cousin it would be completely fine for me to have a gun. So, like, I got a gun. Are you saying that wasn't a proper procedure? And he's and of course, well, no, it wasn't a proper procedure, but it does seem to have been a very liberal and relaxed attitude to getting a gun license. So every so often they would just cancel all the gun licenses, right? Nobody's got a gun license now. You're all going to have to reapply because people have been abusing the system. But, you know, this is also obviously a period in which the tipping of officials at City Hall when you get your gun license is quite standard up to a point. And clearly there's a fine line between giving the appropriate tip to the official who's issuing your license and giving an unusually large tip to this same official in return for getting a license that you probably shouldn't be having. And you know, that's incredibly hard to police. And one of the arguments that I'm making in the book is that, you know, that we're in a period of state formation here, and you can see how the sort of nascent state is really struggling to manage this new technology because it doesn't really have the policing capacity to do it. And the defense interests are pulling it in a different direction of a fairly liberal attitude towards arms production and so forth. So, yeah, it really is an interesting study also in how governments deal with technology and how weak governments struggle to deal with it.
I love, one of my favorite examples of that is the amending the laws, the gun control laws, to make it very explicit that women can't own guns too. Like, is that result, you know, it's the classic thing of, are they amending this because something very specific happened, or are they just tidying up legislation?
You know? The guy who came down, he said, oh no, that's not my gun, that's my wife's gun. And who suddenly realised they've got a loophole in the law and that nobody ever banned his wife from having a gun. And, you know, whatever. I don't know. The other bit that I like about women with guns is the incredible, like, frustration of the Venetian official who is trying to police the main gun-producing area up in the valleys from Brescia. So these are the sort of foothills of the Alps, closer to Milan, but at this point they are under the rule of Venice. As this official is like, these people are getting a bit into this new Protestantism business. We don't really like it. There's a lot of religious radicals up there, even the women. The women are all Lutherans and they go about with two guns each, one in their hand and one at the belt, and they're wheel lock guns, which is a combination. Women, wheel lock guns, Lutheranism, you know, very, very bad. Very bad news all around, really.
But that's a fascinating comparison again as well, because once you move out, I mean, it's outside the scope of this episode, maybe we should do another one on it. But yeah. Like, when you hit into, say, the Netherlands and areas like that, where you do get that Protestantism coming in, and I'm not saying it's an equal society in any way, but we start getting art that features women carrying guns, you know, it's seen as a thing in those areas in a different way, isn't it?
I think that there are definite tensions around gender and guns. We see very few references to women in the gun crime records. I mean, we do see some women who own guns in the Italian records, but I think, yeah, the idea of women as participants in, say, shooting guilds to any extent is much more of a Northern European thing than it is a Southern European thing. And that, you know, mirrors broader patterns around kind of ideas of gender and honour in Northern and Southern Europe. But yeah, it's interesting that sometimes, you know, you get quite routine notes, particularly in the context of fears about siege warfare, where, yes, women will have guns in their house and that's considered ordinary and normal and appropriate in context, but outside of those immediate contexts of war, and that the siege, which is a place where women are allowed to do self-defense. And more generally, yeah, the guns are quite sort of gendered masculine.
Again, that's why I do find this transition of perception so important, because, like, as we said at the top of the episode, like, these are specifically at the beginning of this period being described as, literally being described as unmanly. And that progression from unmanliness to now this is a manly weapon is not only just, it's almost like it's sort of doubly patriarchal, because it's like, firstly, it's like only women will use this, and then it's progressing to, no, this is too manly, women shouldn't use this. It's like there's no ground in between.
There's no sort of logic to how this works. I think the idea of the gun as manly or not That sticks around for quite a long time. I mean, the proper duel is really fought with swords. And I think there's a stronger, like, as you go on even into the 18th century, there's a sense of attitudes towards the different weapons, swords versus pistols. I don't know. I think it feels like a duel with swords is more proper.
There's some fantastic accounts I've seen of Prussian officers who are horrified that the Americans fight duels with guns, and that they see that in that context. They can't possibly be any good at war if they look at these people. They fight duels with guns, not with they haven't got a single sword scar. You know, how good can they possibly be?
Yeah, and you know, even thinking about crime as well, knife crime is routinely more prevalent than gun crime. I mean, right through in terms of who commits violence and how they commit violence, knives are more widely used. It's just that guns account for more deaths from probably around about the beginning of the 17th century because they're much more lethal as a weapon. So if you shoot somebody, you're much more likely to kill them than you are if you stab them. But guns are still involved in a minority of violent incidents.
And also that as you've mentioned already, that and ties back to our highwayman thing, our bandit thing, is often the threat of a weapon, the visible threat of a weapon. The thing that a wheel lock allows you to do is display it loaded and armed on your belt. That ability to go, look, I have a gun. I can use this gun whenever I want to use it, contributes then in terms of to robbery, in terms of everything else. It becomes an active weapon in those ways.
Yes, and that sort of idea of an immediate threat of lethality. I mean, if you think about the ideal highway robbery, nobody gets shot. The highwayman holds up the coach. They say, you know, your money or your life. The people hand over the money. Highwayman takes it. Off he goes. Coach moves on. Nobody's dead. No shots have been fired. And that works because of the potential that the gun has as a weapon and not because it has actually been used. Whereas, you know, a knife just doesn't work like that. A sword doesn't work like that. Not least, I mean, knives don't work like that because in early modern Europe, everybody carries knives because they use them for eating. They use them as just a generic tool. It's like carrying a penknife. And so if you attack somebody with a knife, extremely high likelihood that they are going to fight back with their knife. With a gun, it doesn't work that way.
And we've talked a bit now about how this sort of general cultural normalization starts to happen, this general acceptance of them existing within civilian society as much as within military society. We should start talking a bit about how this becomes a sort of elite and luxury thing. But maybe just before that, maybe if you didn't mind, would you mind setting the scene for listeners on what the arms industry looks like particularly in the Italian city-states at the time? Because it's much larger, I think, than people maybe realize.
Yeah, I mean, so in one chapter of the book, I have a case study of the arms industry that grows up near the city of Brescia. So that's Venetian territory, getting towards the foothills of the Alps. And this is where Beretta claim their descent from 500 years ago, and where they still have a factory now. And if you imagine this place, it is in a very narrow valley, Val Trompia, high hills, lots of trees, so you've got charcoal, mines with iron ore, so you've got your raw materials, and you've got the power of the river running through the valley to power water mills that would drive the big hammers that hammered out sheets of metal to roll up into gun barrels. Now, in the 1570s, at its peak of production of military weapons, this village, which is basically a village, Gardone Val Trompia, could turn out 300 guns a day, gun barrels. So talking about 100,000 a year. And that's, you know, to equip the Venetian Navy, primarily when they're involved in the war with the Ottomans. So that's probably quite a high production level, but that's what they could do. And that's just the main Venetian production center. This is before we get to the fact that by that point in the 1570s, Florence has also got factories, Lucca has got factories and so on. So other places are producing too. So we're talking about hundreds of thousands of guns going into society every year. And of course, some of them break and rust and get thrown away and so forth. But you can see the level of proliferation that's possible with those numbers. Because the arms industry then creates another sort of policy issue for governments in that if you want capacity to produce 100,000 a year when necessary, you have to think about what you're doing with your surplus capacity in the years when you are not directly fighting a war. Are you going to export those spare weapons? Are you going to let them be sold to private merchants or into a civilian market? How do you manage that? And so we actually see an export license system already in place in the 16th century, which is quite astonishing to me. I did not really expect to see something so systematic, but it's already there. It's a way of managing arms production from very, very early on. If you are a foreign state that wants to buy from the producers in Venetian territory, you need to make an application.
And a transit license system as well. I think that's the fascinating side of it as well. Like, because it's not just, you know, if you want to buy guns from a place, you're probably going to need to move them through other places, which means you need transit licenses to move this stuff through as well.
Oh, yeah, transit licenses, transport, question of who's paying for transport, you know, who's getting the barge operators involved, all these different, you know, ways, and how you track that inventory as it moved. Because if you are buying 5,000 guns and they've got to go down the river to Ferrara, you do not want any of those guns to get lost. So you actually have all these bills of lading where they've got these numbered boxes checked off, you know, which barge operator has got which numbered boxes. And then at the end, can we reconcile those numbered boxes with the ones that have actually arrived at their eventual destination? So a lot of effort going in as well to controlling those supply chains and trying to make sure that too many guns don't accidentally fall out of the route that they are meant to be taking, which, I mean, you know, if you were a highway robber, is surely a risk that box of guns just goes astray.
So this leads us nicely, I think, into talking a bit more about how this becomes from a nobility, from an elite perspective, from a high society perspective, how the shift happens into both guns as gifts, novelty as part of that, but that shifts in as decorative items that, like, as you said at the top of the show, like, that we don't really get today because we see them in a big cabinet in a museum and we forget that this might well have been on the wall behind a desk, or it might have been on the desk, it might have been part of it. So obviously we come back again in a bit, in a sort of way, to southern Germany as well. We've talked about the growth of luxury production there, but also it's something you talk about a lot, which I hadn't really realized, is the level in that period, obviously, of marriages between high society families within the Italian city-states with German families, which then means that, that those brides are coming down and that guns become part of that transition process in terms of the entry of guns, of imperial guns, i.e. from the HRE, start to come in that way as much as anything else.
Yeah, it's one of the ways that after basically winning the Italian wars, the Habsburg dynasty consolidates its power in Italy is by doing a lot of marriage alliances with the different Italian states. And so, yeah, you get a lot of German commanders coming in. You get a lot of German ducal bodyguards. So, I mean, Cosimo de' Medici had German bodyguards at one point, and with them come these luxury guns. And so there's lots of integration of guns into a court society that is very focused on giving these diplomatic gifts, both from one state to another, but also within any given state between the Duke and officials or vice versa. So there's an interesting switch in the middle of the 16th century in Mantua, where it's been a tradition for the podestas of the cities, the people who are kind of responsible for kind of maintaining law and order and running the city, to give the Duke a present of crossbows. And in the middle of the 16th century, they switch and that becomes a gift of guns. So you can see how that change is happening. And these weapons are also interesting because they fit in a material way to the decorative sort of aspects of court life. So, for example, the scenes that you might get on the side of a gun, so they can be Sometimes they're scenes of the hunt, sometimes they're images of foliage, sometimes they're classicizing scenes. So there's one gun, which is great, which is originally from Styria, in the Art Institute in Chicago, and it's got the Judgment of Paris on the side of it. So Paris choosing between the goddesses. And, you know, you also see Cleopatra on the side of guns. You see Judith on the side of guns, different, a variety of images, all of which you would very readily see on tapestries on the side of the room. You would see the same materials being used in furniture, luxury furniture. So you have things like ebony and ivory, different types of wood, etching, gilding, all these techniques that really make the gun fit into the broad material culture of the court. And so it starts to belong. And they also have these very, very many different types of novelty weapon that come in and appeal to the sort of sense of fun that, you know, surrounds court life. So what sort of entertainment things keep them occupied. So yeah, there are some really bizarre sort of combination weapons out there.
Yeah, you get that. You see examples. I always like to keep an eye out for them when I'm wandering around museums, because there'll always be one somewhere. And obviously, we don't have as many guns that survive from this period in particular. A lot of the stuff is from slightly later, but that trend continues. But yeah, when you see things that, like, you know, every time you see one of those random guns in the Tower of London or somewhere else, and it's got like an axe head or whatever else, it was never really designed to be used in battle this way. This is the kind of weapons that Catherine's talking about. They are there almost to act as a set piece. There's something to talk about at your noble party. There's something you bring out and show people. They're acting as a focus of spectacle. And similarly, as guns, as the mechanisms for wheel locks get smaller, that process of, oh, let's slide a wheel lock pistol into a dagger. Let's slide it into a sword handle. Let's do these things. Now, when you see those weapons in museums, there can be sometimes a thought, oh, this must be something that people were carrying in self-defense. Actually, no, a lot of the time it's just there to be a visual object. It's something to talk about.
I did find one multi-barrel gun in an inventory. So clearly people did experiment and have them, but you sort of suspect that they were set off ceremonially, probably. And, you know, your boar spear with two small arquebuses inside, I mean, you know, you don't want the faff of, like, trying to set off your wheel lock arquebus when you get to find the boar at last. This is not going to be very helpful all the way around. So, yeah.
The element with that is obviously standardization matters. You're not going to be running around with lots of weird different weapons in actual warfare, as you described it. This is about people standing in lines and firing and acting as coherent units. So they are very much visual objects. They're objedar as much as anything else. Like, I do love that about them. But maybe also, like, you mentioned it briefly, but we talked about the gift culture. And I think the gift culture is worth talking about, because it's not just about sort of bribing. It is that there is a genuine culture of gift giving, almost in return for sort of unofficial services sometimes. I think you give an example in when you're talking about Brescia, of how if you want to serve as a member on the kind of the noble elite, the council level in Brescia, you can't be doing trade. So becoming almost an informal power broker becomes a way of doing things, and gift giving is a very useful way of informally being a power broker.
Yeah, so I had a great find in the archives in Brescia, which was the account books of a local nobleman, a sort of patrician of the city, who turned out to be doing some arms broking. And that was really interesting, because you can see him facilitating these transactions, but he's not an arms dealer in the sense of taking a cut. He's more of a facilitator. And what he seems to get out of it is he gets out of it eventually a contract, a mercenary type contract for his son, to raise 300 cavalry, which is a very nice type of contract to get at this point if you're an upwardly mobile family. But he is giving gifts all over the place. He's giving these luxury weapons, mainly not guns, actually, but to the nephew of one of the members of the Venetian Senate, for example. He's going to, you know, let me give this nephew a little stiletto. Let's get a little bit of armor made up for somebody. And all these gifts, yeah, smooth social transactions. Some types of gifts can also be monetized by being sold or being pawned. So particularly a bit lower down the social scale. I mean, I doubt very much that Venetian patricians really have to pawn their gilded daggers. But if you're a more ordinary person who is on hard times and you've been given a nice gift, then you can get some money for it if you want. So there's a large element of people's incomes which doesn't come straightforwardly in wages. It might come in expected gifts from your employer, from the local ruler. And this, you know, gifts are just a very, very big part of the generalized economy. When one of the ways that guns become legitimized is by fitting into this whole sort of process of gift giving, being exchanged, being accepted, becoming, normalized as gifts. And I think that that's a part of the way that they overcome some of that image as diabolical.
And that's we largely start to see that sort of 1550s onwards, don't we? Because that's when we start to see that transition to that as a model.
Yeah, there's a real interesting turning point in terms of artworks, including guns, which comes in 1548, when Titian paints a big equestrian portrait of the Emperor Charles V, whose troops have just had a nice victory over the Protestants in 1547 at Muhlberg. And he shows Charles on horseback with a wheel-lock pistol at his hip. And that is, to my knowledge, one of the earliest portraits of a European ruler, or indeed any sort of European aristocrat, with a handgun. And this is a point at which I think guns start to get legitimized. Of course, a religious victory is one way to sort of suggest that guns are now God's work rather than the devil's. And so we get more of that discourse. We get more religious motifs, religious mottos on guns, more examples of images of the crucifixion on guns from around about the 1540s onwards.
But also not just religious imagery. I think one thing I love is, which I'd never made the connection, is when you see what is very much a sort of image of Venus or something on the side of a gun or of a decorative pistol or similar. Is that, as I think you make the comparison in the book, it's no different from painting those girls on bombers in World War II.
Oh yeah, there are quite a lot of guns with sexy ladies on the side, and in traditional Renaissance fashion, if you give your sexy lady a little label saying she's Venus, then that's okay. You know, she can be as naked as you like because she's a goddess, and that's sort of acceptable. She can be sort of Cleopatra with the asp and sort of largely topless, so you get a whole bunch of that kind of imagery. You get sort of scenes of courtship. There is Chicago again, have a couple on the side of a cartridge box, I think, getting very up close, sort of sitting on top of each other. So there's lots of that type of imagery as well. Interestingly, a lot of the women who you see on the side of the guns are women who are associated with conflict or war in some way. So, you know, Judith holding the head of Holofernes as the sort of general who she's assassinated, or as I say, Helen of Troy, who, you know, personally responsible for the Trojan War, all her fault.
It's always women's fault. I mean, yes, I think, by the way, you have just nominated yourself for my episode on the Renaissance is just OnlyFans for a different generation episode.
Yeah, I mean, there's a fair amount of that about. I mean, the other thing I would say about the classical scenes on the side of guns is that, obviously, the Renaissance is meant to be the rebirth of classical culture, right? And so guns don't easily fit into that because they have no obvious classical precedent. So one of the ways you can make them fit in is by putting gods and goddesses and the Trojan War and so on on the side.
No, no Latin word for gun. You know.
There is no Latin word for gun. This is a problem. All these writers are having to come up with really convoluted metaphors about thundering bronze tubes to avoid using a neologism, which is very bad. You don't want to do that because it stops you sounding like Cicero, which is the ambition of every sort of Renaissance writer, is to write this sort of perfect Latin poetry or prose. And yeah, guns are a quite uncomfortable fit into that. So you get much more chat about guns in more vernacular type of literature, the kind of verse accounts of current events in the wars that were published as pamphlets and so on.
But again, the fact that they're trying to work these in, that they're trying to find ways to frame these in a classical sense, is further evidence of just how much this has become a normalized part, particularly for the from an elite perspective, that this is, they want this to be part of that framework. Now, the transition has clearly happened now.
They can't really avoid it. I mean, particularly by the time you get to the 1570s and all these writers are writing up the great Christian victory over the Ottoman Empire at the Battle of Lepanto, and guns, cannon, all sorts of gunpowder weapons, very important by this point on both sides. So they can't really get away from the fact that they are there, but they have this awkwardness around them. I think it's partly why you still, you know, even at this point, for all that we do have that Charles V equestrian portrait, it's still only just becoming standard to see people portrayed with guns in formal portraits. And actually the places that you get those are mostly related to either the religious wars. So you get some related to the Dutch Revolt. You get some in Ireland, which is obviously also a sort of imperial and colonial project on the part of the English crown. And so you start to get guns there. And we get guns in the more explicitly imperial narratives, both visual and textual. So one of the most impressive pictures that sums this up is a portrait of Sir Martin Frobisher, which is in the Bodleian Libraries now, in which he is there standing in full his sort of Elizabethan garb, and he's got a very tiny wheel-lock pistol. He's got a globe behind him, and it's like, here is the gun conquering the world in the person of Sir Martin, who's been off to try and find the Northwest Passage. But this, you know, that sort of association of empire and guns is also a big part of the picture.
Maybe we'll finish the main part of this episode off. We've talked about firearms. We haven't talked about all the stuff that happens around firearms, which is similarly part of this visual culture of what happens with this and everything else. Example, sort of the stuff you carry your powder in, how you're carrying the gun, how you're wearing the gun. All those things become subject to the same level of imagery and display, don't they?
Yeah. So if you're carrying a gun, you will also need a powder flask. So there are lots of very, very finely decorated powder flasks. And generally you have two powder flasks. You have the bigger one for carrying the supplies, and you have a small priming flask, which measures out the correct dose of gunpowder for your weapon. And so even when you put in an order for new guns, often you said, order the guns with the accessory and with all the barrel, the stock, the lock for the gun itself, then the various bits and pieces that you need to carry it. And so all these provide opportunities for decoration. They also draw in a whole bunch of other industries to being sort of auxiliary to the arms industry, if you like, some associated industries. So you have people who are responsible for cleaning, for transport, for repair. You have shopkeepers. You have experts in fixing up the wheels of wheel lock pistols, because that can be a little bit of a tricky thing, and it gets these complaints that clockmakers are getting into this business and illegally restoring wheel locks. So that's another way on the industrial side that guns filter into society, because you tie in a whole group of people into these supply chains, and then they become financially dependent on the industry, or at least somewhat tied to it. So if the industry suddenly cuts production, they're going to have to find something else to do, and that's a problem for them. So yeah, in all these different dimensions, guns become normalized, become common objects, become familiar in different ways, to the point that by the time we get to the 1570s, and I'm reading accounts of assassination by firearm, you know, which today are often cited as the first assassination by firearm, nobody is really mentioning that. Nobody is very conscious of the fact this is some sort of novelty. They're just like, so they killed this guy. And that was that, and that's the story that's told. It's not special in some way. It doesn't sort of stand out. It's just a thing that happened. And of course they used a gun because that would make sense for an assassin in these circumstances.
But I think that's the perfect place to leave it for our regular listeners. So, but before we go, I mean, your latest book's brilliant. And I'm not just saying that because I'm chatting to you now. Like, it is a great book. And listeners, the stuff we've talked about today, if you found this fascinating, like, this isn't even the whole book. Like, I think maybe this is, we've talked about basically about what we'll cover, maybe like 2-3 chapters in it. give us a bit more context, Catherine, on the full sweep of the book, and wave it for camera,
okay,
if you've got a copy.
So for camera, here's the book. On the front, we have something we haven't talked about. This is an angel with an arquebus, which is actually produced by indigenous artists in the Andes. And it sort of sums up how the religious side of the guns eventually sort of became respectable and even became formalized in art out in the Spanish Empire. So yeah, really through the book, I start with the military context, I go through the arms industry and arms dealing, then I talk about guns in wider society, and I move into the visual culture, the cases of assassination, and then end up out in the European empires, thinking about how the stories that were told of guns in the imperial context helped to come back to Europe and legitimize them as a technology that in certain contexts made Europeans superior, or at least that was how they liked to tell it. So I think, it, you know, I try to give a holistic view of the gun from multiple different angles and think about not just the users, but the producers and the dealers and the people who were sort of on the sidelines of gun use, as well as, you know, people who tried to police guns or people who are opposed to the policing of guns. Then we get to kind of, there's a whole gun control debate going on in there that we haven't really talked about today, but will be surprisingly recognizable for anybody who has ever run into the current debate in the United States. So that's all, you know, very present in the background, although I've tried to not make it the main thing of the book, even though it's one of the things that is going to interest a certain readership. So yeah, it was a, you know, it's been a very long time in the making, this book, but it's been really fascinating to research.
I read it when I was passing through Bremen, Hamburg, Gothenburg, doing various things. And this was the perfect book to read at late night on the ferry from Kiel to Gothenburg and all of that kind of thing. So it's incredibly readable, as well as obviously very, very, you know, a proper historical text. But I'm hoping you'll come back on to talk about the latter half of what we just talked about there, that the imagery around this and that new world imagery and how that changes is just as fascinating, I think. Before we leave regular listeners, I do want to offer one shout out for one book we haven't mentioned yet, which is why I'm hoping you'll be back on at some point. But it's for people to hear you in a very different context, which is I do want to give a shout out to Catherine's book, The Roads to Rome. I think it's fantastic. So just as a final thing for regulars, Catherine, give a bit of a précis on that one as well.
So The Roads to Rome is a book that is part travel and part history, but it's about 2,000 plus years of people traveling to Rome and on the Roman road network, just narrating why it is that Roman roads are so fascinating and how that image of the Roman road has sort of set the Roman Empire and its sort of footprint, if you like, in stone across whole parts of Europe and indeed beyond. And I go off and explore all sorts of fascinating places on the Roman roads that you perhaps would not know, as well as some more familiar ones, and, you know, all sorts of writers and artists who travel those roads, as well as I say, you know, throwing in along the way a bit of my own experience of traveling, for example, from Istanbul or Constantinople along the Via Ignatia through northern Greece and Albania, and then getting a ferry across from Durres up to Bari and then up the Via Appia towards Rome. So lots of journeys like that both people took historically and I was taking in the present.
Well, regular listeners, Catherine, thank you again. And regular listeners and viewers, we're going to leave you here. Don't forget, you can go to untitled-history.com and you can subscribe to get the extra bit that Catherine and I are about to record, as well as extra videos and book recommendations and everything else. The show notes for this episode will have links in them specifically. Normally, I would do like show notes and quite detailed show notes for this. I'm not going to do them for that one because, handily, Catherine, you've done them for me effectively.
What I've done is, I mean, particularly for people who are researching this own topic for their personal interest or who are educators who want to teach about it, I have put together a big guide to English language and or visual primary sources that are online. And so you can go and actually look at some of the images I've been talking about, look at some of the objects I've been talking about across multiple museum collections for yourself. You can dip into the books where people write about guns from this period and see what they were saying. So all that is going to be up there for you on my website in the guide to primary sources.
And I will include a link to that directly in the show notes so people can just get quickly over to it as well. I'm going to put that in the YouTube bit as well. Listeners, again, like, subscribe if this is your first time listening. Those stuff helps. Tell someone offline that you enjoyed the podcast and recommend it to it. Word of mouth is huge for podcasts. And I'm grateful to everyone listening. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. And now, if you're a subscriber already, hang around because Catherine and I are going to carry on chatting. And Catherine, I'm going to start with an interesting question on that. And that question is, what is the weirdest novelty gun you've encountered either in your research or wandering around a museum? You've been listening to the Untitled History Podcast, a Battle Guide production. If you've enjoyed this episode and would like to support the podcast, why not head over to our dedicated supporter page? There, for the cost of a cup of tea, you can decide which subjects we cover next, get access to exclusive behind-the-scenes content, and join a community of like-minded people. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Today, we'll be exploring why and when this changed. And there's the theme. In the 15th century, guns were often seen as the devil's weapon. No, I did that bit, didn't I?
Yeah.
There you go, there's our first edit.